on the chapter 12 of Mosiah, and where Mosiah comes among them, gains entrance in disguise, and once in the midst of them, he throws off the disguise. That is a common device of the prophets. Angels do it. Men have often entertained, we're told, angels unawares, and the Lord himself, we're told, well, was not recognized. But it's the way to get an audience. Well, now, then the next, we have a very interesting thing here. This, the description, well, this is an important element we've got to mention here right now. The second one, the Lord said unto me, stretch forth thy hand and prophesy. And this is what's going to be happening. This is the picture you see. They shall be brought into bondage. They shall be smitten on the cheek. They shall be driven by men. They shall be slain, the vultures of the air, and the dogs, yea, the wild beasts, shall devour their flesh. He goes on. Now, this is resumed when somebody reports this to the king later on in the 11th and 12th verses, and the things that shall happen. But the this picture here, well, and then the fourth verse, they shall come, they will smite my people with sore afflictions, with famine and pestilence, because that they shall howl all day long. I will cause that the burden shall be lashed upon their backs. They shall be driven like the dumb ass. Well, they're really pouring it on, you see. Well, that's a very characteristic element, as you know, in Mesoamerican, South American art. The recentest thing I could get, a recent geographic, depicts that. Now, you notice in this art, this is typical of a scene. You notice these things are seen number by the hundreds, pictures like this. This is the way they're treating their enemies and their prisoners in this particular one. It's in the October Geographic. And you notice the violence, this ferocity, the unmitigated savagery of these drawings. It's absolutely deliberate, and it's not only, this is way down in Peru, you see, from a very rich tomb there, and you find the same thing up in Mexico, and you find the same thing in Central America. But why this dedicated viciousness in these things? Notice it isn't, things aren't done halfway. This is rather characteristic of the thing, this going to extremes. They've illustrated this one here, what's going on. You notice the lavishness and the wealth and so forth. This is the wealthiest tomb yet discovered in Peru. But you notice it's a thatched roof and that sort of thing. It isn't the sort of thing that, that what's his name, Arnold Freeberg imagines. Though fabulously rich, this sort of thing, you know. This is in this tomb. Marvelous stuff, but notice the deliberate hideousness of things. Why they make such gorgeous things and make them as hideous as they can is an interesting psychological study, isn't it? He has some more here. Here's the richness of the tomb, the way they found it. Again, it's the fields who feel. They just pour it on. You don't recognize much there. That's the way they found the guy. But this costly apparel and the feathers, I say, and the beads and the jewelry and the clinking and the flapping, they're just walking Christmas trees, these people. And this is a thing that is often reflected in the Book of Mormon, this excess, and especially this treatment of the enemies, the way it's described here, many pictures of them. They're a favorite theme. This, like this theme here, they're cutting people's throats and so forth. And they show lots and lots of tears, lots and lots of pictures with vultures eating people and dogs, and that's what he says here. They will smite you, they will cause to be lashed, burdens on their back. They have some famous pictures with the one people bearing the burdens and the others driving them and so forth. And the driven and shall be slain, and the vultures of the air, the dogs, the wild beasts shall devour their flesh. And we have pictures all over as if they gloated on that sort of thing. It's a most interesting aspect of the Book of Mormon, this savagery. And then we come to this, the east wind and the insects and the pestilence. Well, which follows the war, of course. And then the eighth verse tells us, I will utterly destroy them from off the face of the earth, yet they shall leave a record behind them. I will preserve them for other nations that shall possess this land, yea, the land, excuse me, even this will I do, that I may discover the abominations of this people to other. Well, why worry about the abominations? Why go out of your way to show how abominable? Why do you keep the record just to show that these people were destructive, that they were wicked, and this is what happened to them? This seems to be a very negative approach to history, doesn't it? Well, this is for a definite reason, from a definite purpose. We should know that by today. See, civilizations and cultures do not have to be destroyed. There are cycles of good and bad. You get those in Spengler and Thomas Henry Buckle and the cycler theory of civilizations. They have a youth, a maturity, and an old age, and then they collapse. It's just routinely, it's happened to many of them. And yet, we have that goes with civilization, you see. acquisitive, expansive. You can't do that forever. You will always collapse if you have an acquisitive and expansive. We seem to think that unless the GNP goes up every year, we're in trouble. If it stands still, then nothing's going to happen. But we talk about the stable civilizations that have been there for thousands of years and still doing very well, thank you. On this continent, too, as far as that goes. No, they are permanent. They are such. You can see on these documentaries, people that they call, they've misnamed them savages, New Guinea and things like that. They say, well, since the Stone Age, they've been living like this for millions of years. Not necessarily that, but they have a stable form of existence. Their food supply is regular. A lot of that's being a lot of lamentation now about the destruction of the jungle, about destruction of all resources, about destruction of the ozone and everything. It can't go on, you see. You can't expand that way. And then it always shows us, if we just leave these things alone, where the balance of nature is established, and wouldn't try to prey on each other and try to get richer and richer, people are able to go on indefinitely and enjoy themselves. They have a good time. It's much better than our miserable rat race that everybody complains about. They're always under pressure. So there are these noble savages of the 16th and 17th century explorers and the Jesuits and others were impressed by, they called noble savages, the first people that Columbus met and so forth. They had no weapons. They didn't fight at all. It's a very interesting thing. Lots of people like that have been found. And the noble savage wasn't all a myth. There's something to it. Know more about it now. And so we see these things, and people seem to be very happy. But this time, Abinadi expected to be caught, of course. He threw off the disguise, said who he was. He wants an audience with the king, and he gets it. Of course, they take him to the king. And they accuse him of this prophecy. Now, this is a very interesting study in textual criticism. I will put into this now. Because this is what he says. The life of King Noah shall be valued even as a garment in a hot furnace. He shall know that I am the Lord. And again he saith that thou shalt be as a stock, even as a dry stock of the field, which is run over by the beasts and trodden. And again he saith, thou shalt be as the blossom of a thistle, which when it is fully ripe, the wind bloweth. Now these passages are very interesting because they are found, I was talking the last time about a parallel case of the teacher of righteousness in the Dead Sea Scrolls, who goes through the same routine, the same persecution, the same hiding and everything else as Abinadi. And essentially it happened about the same time, but it was in the old world. And he prophesies too, and he uses the same expressions. Now, these expressions, we see they come from a common source. There are references in the 50th chapter of Isaiah. Let me see 168 here and what this is about here. This is what it comes down to, you see. Now, if you can, well, I've written it down here. You could say, should we do it? Well, first you put down Isaiah 59:11. Isaiah speaks about, this is the way Isaiah speaks about it. He talks about, who is he that shall condemn me? See, this is the prophet speaking, just as Abinadi is speaking, just as the teacher of righteousness is speaking. And they both quote Isaiah. They quote it in a very interesting way from an older text, and we find the parallel text in the, not in Joseph Smith and the Bible, which he could have used, but in Joseph Smith and the Dead Sea Scrolls, which he couldn't have used, of course, they were a recent discovery. But they cite the same, they quote it in the same way that Joseph Smith goes. Well, if you can keep this straight, it's a neat example of textual criticism here now. So Isaiah says, who is he that he shall condemn me? Lo, they shall wax old as a garment. Now, he's not talking about the garment being burned. But he says, a moth shall eat them up. That's what happens to garment. Behold, all ye that kindle a fire, that compass yourselves about with sparks, walk in the light of your fire, and the sparks ye shall kindle. You people that play with fire. See, these irresponsible prophets, priests rather, their wickedness and so forth, they're playing with fire, and you'll be burned up by it, you see, as far as that goes, you see. You play with fire. And then he says, bearing that in mind, what does the Dead Sea Scroll man say? For those who stubbornly oppose God, there shall be violence and overpowering and a flame of fire. They are playing with fire and throwing sparks. Now, I suppose he got that from Isaiah. This is from the Damascus Covenant, 5:13. They are playing with fire and throwing sparks around. And then the next verse is interesting. Their weaving is a flimsy thing, the weaving of spiders. Notice how Abinadi combines them. You play around with flimsy old garments and put them in the fire, they'll be burned in a hurry. And here he says they're playing with sparks, they're throwing fire around, and their weaving, their arguments and so forth, are flimsy as the weaving of spiders. And then he says another thing. Thou scatterest the remnant of the men who fight against me like chaff before the wind. Now Abinadi saith that thy life shall be as a garment in the fire of furnace. And he says again, thou shalt be as a thistle, as the blossom of a thistle which the wind bloweth. Well, I guess they got that from the first psalm about, yes, of course, the wicked man, Rasha, Ka'etz Asher Pidpenuruch, yes, Wahaya Ka'etz Asher, and he shall be as chaff kaputz, which the wind bloweth, as chaff before the wind. But the thing is, Abinadi puts them in the same combination that the teacher of righteousness does in the old world. They're both using the same old text, is the point. It's an older text. So remember, we have the Isaiah text from the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, is 1,000 years older than our Old Testament Isaiah. Isaiah doesn't, we don't get that for the 9th century, and this is the 1st century B.C. So this is the older text, and Abinadi cites the older text. But notice, Abinadi is the most interesting character from the point of view of literature as anybody, then most interesting of, genitive of separation, of any writers in the Book of Mormon, because he's very subtle, he's very clever. He's going to give a long speech here, and he uses puns, he has a bitter humor, it comes through in a bit, and he knows the scripture, he sticks them in number, he chides these people for not knowing the scriptures, for their ignorance. They claim to know it, and he says, you're ignorant, you don't know anything about it. So that's what he's talking about. This in a fair, though, when he talks in this way, the life of King Noah shall be valued even as a garment in a hot furnace. He that saith thy life shall be garment as a garment in the furnace of fire, his servants report to him. And again, he saith, thou shalt be as blossoms of thistle which the wind bloweth. And at the same time, the teacher of righteousness was saying, those who oppose God, there shall be violence, flame. They're playing with fire and throwing sparks. Their weaving is a flimsy thing, the weaving of spiders, you see. The other is the weaving, is the likeness of thistles. And thou scatterest the remnant men like chaff, there's your thistle, see, like chaff before the wind. So they play with these ideas and bring them in. And a neat literary problem in the Book of Mormon here. And we proceed then, he tells them about that, what have we got here? Now, here's the next thing they come to. Thou sayest, they say, remember, and now, O king, what great evil hast thou done, or what great sins have thy people committed, that we should be condemned of God or judged of this man? And now, O king, behold, we are guiltless, and thou, O king, hath not sinned. Therefore, this people hath lied concerning you and have prophesied vain things. How do we know we're righteous? Because we have prospered, they say. Behold, we are strong. We shall not come into bondage or be taken captive by our enemies, yea, and thou hast prospered in this land. Thou hast prospered in this land, and thou shalt also prosper. Talk about the king. And so they go on. They think they're pretty nice, you see. And this is an important thing. The message here is, we are strong, we are good, because we are strong and prosperous. And a special concern of the prophets, and especially in the Book of Mormon, is with the self-image. This is a big thing in the Book of Mormon, as you know. The more corrupt and wicked people are, the more they insist on their respectable, proper, decent, upright self-image. After all, who dresses flawlessly in the height of style always goes to match the mafioso, of course. Or criminals are very proper. Well, if you've seen plenty of TV dramas here, you know the old fellas, Dynasty and so forth. Most respectable, ultra-respectable people are those that are up to the nastiest business, you see, on all fronts as far as that goes. So you have to have this front of respectability and righteousness, and they work on it awfully hard. And it has something to say about our times, too, so you can see that easily. But this is a necessary fiction, see, if they are to meet the charges and put the prophets in the wrong. I'm sorely tempted, and I'm going to yield to temptation this time. Treated something I wrote 36 years ago in a journal on this subject. It's a long article, but... And thus Western civilization was nursed in the schools on a legend of Western goodness. This is the 4th century. Hic est Ausonia, the Western world of clean, fresh, simple, unspoiled pioneers, the Americans' image abroad, you see. This fiction became very cornerstone of the official Virgilian doctrine of Romanitas. Rome was great because Rome was good, we're quoting here. The emperors who after the 2nd century took the name of Pius and Felix were giving expression, we're told, to the old Roman belief in the close association between piety and success, unquote. Who am I quoting here from Volk, yes. while indulging in the ingrained Roman vice blatantly paraded throughout the whole of Latin literature, of dwelling with a kind of morbid fascination on one's own simple goodness, like Horace in describing his meal, or the integer vitae, integer vitae, calorisque puris, etc., famous ode, telling me how pure I am. Schoolboys have been told for centuries that the Romans were simple, severe, and virtuous folk with a near monopoly on pietas and fides, piety and fide, and faith, because forsooth the Romans themselves always said so, though almost every page of their record contradicts the claim. What better demonstration for the effectiveness of the official propaganda? Teachers and orators drilled the essentials of Western goodness into their pupils and auditors until by the 4th century, when hardly a speck of ancient virtue remained, men could talk of nothing but that virtue. They go right on sinning, Salvian reports. Salvian was a Christian who made a big tour, the grand tour through all Europe, all over the place, in the 4th century, and reported on moral conditions in the church there. And what a report. They go right on sinning, Salvian reports, in the sublime conviction that no matter how vilely they may act or how nobly the barbarians behave, God must necessarily bless them and curse the barbarians for being what they are. Yet Salvian himself shows how well the lesson has been taught when he stoutly affirms that, after all, no barbarian can be really virtuous. To the lessons of the schools, carefully supervised by the government, was added the more aggressive policy of deliberately widening the gulf between the two worlds, the Asiatic world. This was the world of at that time, you see, the Persian Empire. For centuries, barbarian and Roman, East and West, had been mingling on terms of greatest intimacy, producing a borderline culture which was quite impossible to draw the line between one culture and the other. Priscus mentions he visited in the 5th century, mentions quite casually the presence of people from the West visiting relatives in the camps of the Asiatics. He notes the busy coming and going of merchants between the two worlds and describes the kind hospitality shown to him, a complete stranger, in the homes of the Easterners. But with this, he gives us the other side of the picture, the official side, the ubiquitous activity of spies and agents in Roman pay, the infusion into the very court of Attila, that he was a contemporary, visited the court of Attila and described it vividly, into the very court of Attila, large sums of money to corrupt and divide the insane they wanted to destabilize them, you see. The insane and mounting conviction of the rulers of the two halves of the world, both barbarians, each that, see, the other would be, in this case, Theodosius, that each was that his was the divine calling to liberate the human race from the intolerable ambition of the other. The official attitude of the barbarians was set forth a few years after this, in Synesius, instruction to the feeble Emperor Arcadius. Synesius was a flashy character. He was a bishop of in North Africa, in Libya, and he was a fox hunting cleric. He loved to hunt and enjoy life and so forth. He tells us an amusing story. He was going back after a session in Italy, and he was going back to Africa to his bishopric in Africa, Synesius, and it was a Jewish boat he was on. The Jews had a navy. See, they were great sailors. We forget that. And it was a Jewish boat. And as they started approaching the African shore, a terrible storm blew up. And it started blowing them toward the shore, toward the rocks. And the crew worked like fury until the sun went down. Then it was Sabbath. And not a member of the crew would raise a finger after that. They dashed on the rocks. And nothing they could do about it. He describes the wreck and how, what he was able to save and so forth. But they were really observant Jews, you see. As soon as the sun went down, suicide it must be. Here she goes. No one would lift a finger or pull a rope as long as it was the Sabbath. That is what you call Pharisaical religion, isn't it? And he admits that they surpassed the Romans in energy, honesty, reliability, and perseverance, yet for all that they are still barbarians and as liable to murder citizens in their bed as were ever any savage ancestors. Security becomes the name of the game. Your fathers made allies of these Scythians, he tells the young and idiotic emperor. He should have known that there is no virtue in a barbarian. From that day to this, they have simply laughed at us. Lacking the heroic qualities of their fathers, they are slaves. They are a people without a land of their own, hence the proverb, the empty waste of the Scythians, for they're always running away from settled life. See, he didn't understand the significance of nomadic life at all. It didn't mean anything. Sounds like what Nixon said. Plainly, Synesius said there's no such word in Russian as liberty, as freedom. Silliest thing in the world, svoboda. Plainly, Synesius thinks that the primordial ways of the nomads are some new sign of degeneracy. So far was one of the learnedest men of the day, an expert advisor on foreign affairs, from comprehending the Asiatic way of life, which was impinging upon the Roman world at 1,000 points, and then the barbarians just ran over them, that's all. Well, we go on and on. It's quite an article. It's been used in a lot of schools and so forth. law schools, Yale Law School, they used that. It was a required reading years ago, of course. Now we go on here. Yes, so this was, "They are strong, we shall not come into bonds." This was a very religious, sacral society governed by priests and priests, like Thebes. They were priest kings here. What have we got? Now, Abinadi's teaching, well, we go on here. "And Noah caused that the priests should gather," so they're going to consult. Now, the king summoning his wise men together to consult about things is a standard theme in ancient literature, of course. The wise men, not only to baffle Moses, remember or to baffle Elijah, priests of Baal, but the king often, especially in the life of Abraham. Abraham is a child, Abraham is a baby, Abraham is a grown man. Every time Abraham threatens the king immediately calls his wise men, and then there's a contest between them. This goes on. Moses, his staff, ate the seven serpents' staff, the other seven serpents, and actually from the Old Kingdom there is in the pyramid text mention of that, the serpent that eats the seven other serpents, the staffs that eats the seven other staffs, very old sort of thing. So we have this competition between the king and the official wise men. He calls his counselors, he calls the wise men. This is a theme in the scripture. You get it all through the prophets, you know. You get it in Revelation and so forth. They call together the wisest people they have and all their wisdom comes to nothing. They put their heads together and they have no counsel at all. They're absolutely paralyzed. And we reach that station. Just by adding more men to the committee, you're not going to make it any smarter, you see. You might add up their total IQ and get a good 100, but that won't do it, you see. So he does, see. "And he commanded that the priests should gather themselves together that he might hold a council with them, what he should do with him." Now, the king is worried. Now, we've talked about this. Noah, he's a very interesting character, as you know. He's a playboy. He's made himself very popular. He's not entirely bad. He had a good father. His father showed bad judgment in making him king and so forth. But he has his problems. He's going to have more of them, too. And it came to pass, they said to the king, well, let's question him. The king commanded them to bring forward. So they are going to question him. So here we had a disputatio. It's like Luther in Worms, before you bring all the council together and then he faces him, or like Giordano Bruno in Rome and before Councilor Clement VIII, he tried to convert Clement VIII and he failed, so Clement VIII burnt him. But lots of these. You have St. Joan of Arc, the trial of Joan. St. Joan, you know, Shaw's play, where she has to stand before the council and they all take turns asking her questions. That's the routine way of the king's getting rid of somebody who's made himself very, very obnoxious. And the way the person stands up to it and so forth, we have. It's a theme, the Scopes trial and things like that, which you try to make heroes. And so they ask him this. This is the one question they ask him. Notice, they began to question him, they might cross him, that thereby they might have wherewith to accuse him. But he answered them boldly, withstood all their questions to their astonishment. They did not withstand them, for he did withstand them in all their questions. They did confound them in all their words. Now again, we go back to our teacher of righteousness, back in Palestine here. And the same thing happens. It's worded almost the very same way here. yes, the priest began, this is Book of Mormon. "The priest began to question him that they might cross him to accuse him, but to their astonishment he did withstand them in all their questions, they did confound them in their words." And this is what the Hodiot is the thanksgiving hymn of this prophet after he's been delivered by the Lord from their clutches. "They spread a net to catch me, but it caught their own foot. Thou deliverest me from the spite of the manipulators, the rhetoricians of lies." See this very situation. "From the counsel of those who seek smooth things, thou hast rescued the soul of the poor one whom they desired to destroy because of his service to thee. I was zealous against the deceitful men, for all who are near to thee, resist not thy mouth or change thy words." And then he says here, Abinadi says here, "You pretend to teach this people. If you understand these things, you have not taught them. Therefore, you have perverted the ways of the Lord." The Hodiot scroll, the teacher of righteousness, says, "I became an accusing spirit against all who taught smooth things, and all the men of false teaching, deception, illusion, stormed against me. They professed to be in the covenant of repentance." Now, again, in the 27th verse, Abinadi says, you have not applied your hearts to the understanding. You haven't really made an effort to understand. We'll see that in a minute. And they said, we teach the law of Moses. Well, if you teach the law of Moses, why don't you keep it? Why do you set your hearts on riches? See, the first thing he hits that. Why do you commit whoredoms and spend your strength with harlots? And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, they profess to be in the covenant of repentance, but they have not departed from the ways of the apostates. They have wallowed in the ways of whoredoms and godliness. You spend your commit whoredoms and spend your strength with harlots. And the old world says you have wallowed in the ways of whoredoms and godliness. Everyone has deserted his family for immoral practices, zealous in the acquisition of wealth. He brings that in right there, you see. Acquisition of wealth and property. Every man doing what is right in his own eyes, confirming the people in their own sins. As if it had been lifted from the Doctrine and Covenants of the Book of Mormon, these passages from the Dead Sea Scrolls. How valuable they are. And the Dead Sea Scrolls are in discredit. Nobody likes them because they say the wrong thing, as far as that goes. It's very interesting. He goes on, he says, I know if you keep, in the 33rd verse, I know if you keep the commandments of God, you shall be saved, yea? If you keep, this is Abinadi speaking. If you keep the commandments which the Lord delivered unto Moses on the Mount Sinai, have you done all this? Have you taught this people what they should do, all these things? I say unto you, nay, ye have not. Back to the Hodiot, the Thanksgiving hymn. The preachers of lies and the seers of illusions contrive devil's tricks against me to make me exchange the law which thou hast engraved in my heart for the smooth things they teach to the people. They who shut up the drink of knowledge from the thirsting ones, the Lord said this, see, to give them vinegar, to turn them to false teachings, lest they fall into teachings that they fall into your nets. Well, let's go on here. I say unto you, he says, that it is expedient that you should keep the law of Moses, Abinadi, as yet. But I say unto you that the time shall come when it shall no more be expedient to keep the law of Moses, Yahuwah. From no precept shall the Torah, of the Torah shall they depart, until there shall come a prophet and Messiah of Aaron and Israel. See, even that, even the idea of the law was absolute. This was the last word as far as the Jews were concerned. And here we have this Jewish scroll saying, from no precept of the Torah shall they depart until the Messiah comes of Aaron and Israel. And that's exactly what Abinadi teaches them. Therefore, he goes on, Abinadi goes on, therefore there was a law given, a law of performances and ordinances. You have to go through the forms as a drill, keeping yourself on the road, a discipline, well you might understand it, but it prepares you for serious things, which they were to observe strictly from day to day. But they didn't pay attention to that. Easy enough. But behold, all these things were types of things to come. And now they did not understand the law, and this because of the hardness of their hearts. Well, back to the Damascus covenant. And according to this rule, they shall walk even the seed of Israel, and in this way of living for the camp. This is the way they shall walk, again it says, in the time of the wicked, until the anointed, when the Messiah of Aaron arises. There we are again, you see. Did not Moses prophesy, the next chapter, did not Moses prophesy concerning the coming of the Messiah, that God should redeem his people, yea, even all the prophets who have prophesied since the world began? Have they not spoken more or less? It's all been about the Messiah, he said. And the IQS says, as commanded by the hand of Moses and by the hands of the servants, his prophets, to atone for the sins, to please God in the land, more than the flesh of burnt offerings. See, this was the atonement. It goes beyond the old law of Moses. More than the flesh of burnt offerings and the fat of sacrifices, the heat offerings of the lips for a mishpat, like the sacrificial odor, the kinioch, offering acceptable to him. Well, we go on and on here. Very interesting parallels. I didn't realize this was so interesting. I'll have to read it more. but this is the way he goes on now. The
Is there mentioned in the Damascus text the fate of the teacher of righteousness?
Yes, he was, does it tell us what happened to him? He was put to death, all right.
Is there any possibility that the teacher of righteousness?
Well, the thing is, now that's interpreted differently. See, when you have a man of possessions, you mean by a rich man, you see, an ish, well, a man of possessions, or if you say an ish chokhmah, a man of wisdom, you mean wise man, you see. So when you say a man of righteousness, it means a righteous teacher is all. The teacher of righteousness, the teacher who had the quality of righteousness is what it means. It's usually rendered today the righteous teacher. So it could have been, sometimes they call him the star, and he goes by different names, but there were different groups under teachers like that. When they were driven out, of, they were only, 28 miles from Jerusalem when they were driven out by Herod's soldiers. Most of the company went north and settled at Damascus, and that's why this, and then they kept their record there, and then the fragment was found in the Geniza of a wall of an old deserted, and converted to a mosque, deserted synagogue in Cairo by Paul Kala long ago. No, it was Schechter, Solomon Schechter found it, took it up to Cambridge, and it rested there for 27 years. Nobody paid any attention to it at all. And then they found the Dead Sea Scroll, and they said, aha, this is a Dead Sea Scroll. But everybody thought it was a fake. Solomon Zeitlin, the old editor of the Jewish Quarterly Review, he believed it was just a medieval forgery, just a joke. And he would never change his mind. Though hundreds of documents came forth to attest it. That's the way we stand. Well, anyway, he goes on here, stubborn people we're dealing with here, see? Now, why do they ask this question? Well, it's obvious why they ask it, you see. It came to pass that one of them said to him, now this is the key question they ask him. What meaneth the words which are written, which has been taught by our father, saying, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, he goes on. Break forth into joy, sing together, ye waste places of Jerusalem, the Lord has comforted his people. Now what he's asking is this, if you're a true prophet, why don't you bring us this good news? This is the prophet. Why don't you rejoice us? Why don't you teach us to rejoice? That's what prophets teach. What kind of a message? This is the kind of a message you should deliver. He says, this is what prophets teach. Good tidings, the publishes good and salvation, that bring joy and tell you, bring comfort to the people. Why aren't you bringing comfort and joy if you're a real prophet? That's a logical thing to answer, because they believe that we should enjoy ourselves and teach people what they want to hear. So if you were a prophet like this, you'd bring us good news. And the Lord hath made bare his arm in all the nations, and they shall see the salvation of God. Well, that's a cheerful promise. Notice, it is the corrupt priests of Noah now who are quoting these comforting words. They know the scripture too, but how they use them, they to back themselves up. And we reinterpret things today very comfortably for ourselves. Now, and Abinadi says, you're priests and pretend to teach this people these things. You desire to know of me what these things mean. I say unto you, what you've done, you've perverted the words. You are twisting them, as Abraham says. You're perverting the ways of the Lord. You understand these things, have not been taught them. Therefore, ye have perverted the ways of the Lord. You have not applied your hearts to it. You see, it's a lawyer's interest you have in these, the words, how you can manipulate them, how you can interpret them. Just a lawyer's interest. You haven't applied your hearts to understand this at all. Therefore, you haven't been wise. And what are you teaching this people? They said, well, we teach the law of Moses. They insisted, and that's it. He says, and again, if you teach the law of Moses, why don't you keep it? Why do you set your hearts upon riches to commit whoredoms and so forth? He goes on. Cause this people to commit sin, to prophesy against this people, even a great evil against them. You know that I speak the truth. He says, that's why you feel bad. And then the 31st verse, what know ye concerning the law of Moses? Does salvation come by the law of Moses? It's the old law. This is the law of forms and observances. It will, salvation, you see, is atonement. And the center, the climax of all the law is the Day of Atonement, when we become one with everything, you see. Atonement is the universal field. It brings everything in. It's one with the Father. The 17th chapters of John deal with that all the way, how we are one. The Father and the Son is one. The apostles will be one with them. They whom they today preach will be one, even as we are one. We will all be one. We'll all be joined together hereafter in the world to come. And when the world is as it should be, that will be the great at-one-ment, the one bringing together. And this we don't have here. The law of Moses prepares us for that. Ye shall be saved if you keep the commandments of Moses. That will lead you on the way. And then he recites, he gives the Ten Commandments. But notice the thing he plays up here is that there shall not be any images. He talks about that here. Notice over the 12th and 13th verses across the page here, the next chapter. What about the graven image? Why bow down to them and serve them? Because see what was happening. It was a strong tendency at this time in the religion to go to idols. See, idols become the big thing with these people, along with this lush, overdone sort of art and so forth. The image of the idols, the visible display, it becomes a big thing. And so he emphasizes idols, first of all, as the thing, because that's the way the religion was going, and that's the way it went all the way. So he says the first thing about the idols, you shall not bow to them. And then he recites the Ten Commandments here. And he says, have you taught the people that they should do all these things. No, you haven't. And that's why I've come to you, he says. I say unto you, it is expedient that you should keep the law of Moses. But I say unto you, the time will come, it shall be more expedient. It will be no more expedient to keep the law of Moses, but it's certainly not now. You see, that's what he talks about here. No more has that time come, you see. The law of Moses, now if this was an Old Testament class, you'd go through with a fine-tooth comb, through Deuteronomy especially, but naturally Leviticus, Exodus. And the law of Moses is far more humane and broad-minded and more just than the law we live by today in this country. It is. It's amazing how humane and generous and kind it is. And we talk about the old savage tribal law of eye for an eye and so forth. What a lot of nonsense. Because as Benedi says, we don't really study. We don't want to find out what it really says. It's like these people that criticize the Book of Mormon. They ask good questions. They ask searching questions. Questions that should stump anybody, you see. But then they don't wait for an answer. They stomp out of the room on a triumphant note. We've won, you see. See, you can't answer that. Well, if you don't stay, they never wait for an answer. This is the only way they can maintain their ground. But it's a very common procedure, you see, in argument. It's one of the ways the lawyers win things and so forth. But salvation doesn't come by the law alone. No, this is the point here. Were it not for the atonement. See, that's the key. The salvation isn't the law, it's the atonement. The arrangement that the Lord Jesus Christ made by which we are all going to be brought together again and made one, become one with the Father. Without that, they must unavoidably perish. He just died dead. Notwithstanding the law of Moses. The law of Moses doesn't take care of the law of entropy. The Book of Mormon tells us very clearly the atonement does. So he talks about the stiff-necked people. Even a very strict law, they were a stiff-necked people, quick to do iniquity, so the law was adopted to them. Is this the best the Lord could do with the chosen people? Nobody seems to be willing to accept it, and it's true. No one has accepted it. No one keeps the law of Moses today. Are we ready for the higher law? He gave them the law of Moses, which they did not keep. Why do we have lawyers? Why do we need the word of wisdom? The word of wisdom we shouldn't bother about, shouldn't even exist as far as we're concerned. You shouldn't be able to break it as far as that goes. That's a lower law. That's preparatory. But you have to keep it. You're not going to be saved without keeping the word of wisdom. Ah, you say, see, the word of wisdom. Saved by the word of wisdom. Nobody said anything like that. But that is the least, as it says. Remember the introduction of the 87th section. It says, adapted to the least of saints or that any that can be called saints. So this is a step. You have to go through this before you can expect the other thing. So keep these preparatory laws like that. Notice it says in the 30th verse, stating it beautifully, a law of performances and ordinances. You go through, you do certain things, you carry out certain instructions, because this is which they were to observe strictly. You're supposed to keep these laws strictly. Is there virtue in that? Yes, there is. But in nothing else than that? Well, as the prophet says, no, that just prepares you. Then you go on. To keep them in remembrance of God, their duty toward him. That's why we have the sacrament. You see, it's in remembrance. It's about the only set ritual we have outside of the temple, isn't it? The same words always have to be repeated and repeated in exactly the same way, and the bread and water has to be passed the same way and so forth. So we have a right there, and we say it's in remembrance to keep our minds on track, to keep ourselves concentrated on that, to be slow, but to keep remembrance of God and their duty toward him. That's what it is. It's an act of duty. It's an act of obedience. Why do you do this? The Lord asks that. I don't know, save the Lord commanded me. All right, now I'll tell you why. But first he requires that you do it, the law of sacrifice. I say unto you, these things are types of things to come. See, they are similitudes. And they didn't understand the law. Now, they didn't understand the law in the Old Testament. They didn't understand it in the New Testament, as the Lord makes very clear. They don't understand it in the Book of Mormon. We don't understand it in the Pearl of Great Price. Pay practically no attention to it. And we don't understand in the Doctrine and Covenants. We slide over these things as far as that goes. Now, we do not accept, as he says here, the hardness of their hearts, they understood not that they could not any man be saved through the redemption of God. As Mosiah said, remember, always keep this in remembrance, your own nothingness and the greatness and goodness of God. Then, he says, you can always manage to be happy, but that's the thing you have to do. No. Well, didn't Moses speak concerning the coming of the Messiah, he says? And God should redeem the people, even all the prophets? more or less concerning, and all the prophets, this is an important verse in the Book of Mormon, and all the prophets have spoken more or less concerning these things. Well, they could ask, where does Moses speak of these things? And where do the prophets tell us about the Messiah in these sense? And the Jews still ask that. He says, we don't see any Messiah there. Well, the next chapter, he proceeds to recite the score of the Handel's Messiah, the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, which is the score of much of Handel's Messiah. And that's the very thing he was talking about. This describes the coming of the Lord. This says that he shall come in the form of a man, go forth in mighty power, well, and that God himself should come down among the children of men. Yea, have they not said that he should bring to pass the resurrection of the dead? Well, all that is already, it's in the Old Testament, but I say you don't have to see it there, and the Jews don't see it there at all. If you don't believe that, who does, you see? So he goes on here. And back there, the 21st to 22nd verses, to 24th verses, back in the 12th chapter, he talks the same thing. The Lord hath made bare his holy arm in the lives of all the nations, see the salvation of our God. And, break forth in singing Jerusalem. It was the passage they themselves quoted, which prophesies the coming of the Messiah. So he quotes Isaiah 53, these wonderful words. And most people find this impossible to believe, so naturally it starts out, who hath believed our report? And to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? I say most people find it impossible to believe. They say that John and all the rest can't possibly have meant this literally, not out of the question. This is in a spiritual sense, forgetting that if Christ had spoken spiritually, he'd never been had any trouble with the scribes, Pharisees, or anybody else, because spiritual was the thing in that day. Everybody had gone hermetic, you see. A spiritual father, fine, no objection, whatever. Spiritual sacrifice, fine, no objection, whatever. But it's because it was real that they were sorely offended. They couldn't take that. And so it goes up and talks about it. You all know these immortal lines. He is despised and rejected of men, man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. He has borne our griefs. He was wounded for our transgressions. See, this is the atonement, the price that was paid to bring about an atonement, bring about the reconciliation. Because we, like sheep, have all gone astray, we have turned everyone from his own way. Section 1 of the Doctrine and Covenants, every man walketh after the image of his own heart, which is the image of an idol which waxeth old, and shall perish in Babylon, even Babylon the great, which shall perish, and shall fall in Babylon, which shall perish. All we like sheep have gone astray, they have turned away every one in his own way, every man after his own heart. But he was brought as a lamb to the slaughter, that's the sacrifice, you see, before the shearers. And for our transgressions, my people, he was smitten. For the transgressions of my people, he was at the bottom of the 8th verse here, 9th. He made his grave with the wicked, as low as you can get, with the rich in his death, because he had done no evil, neither any deceit in his mouth. Thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin. He shall see his seed, shall prolong his days, and so forth. He shall see the travail of his soul, and shall be satisfied by his knowledge, shall my righteous servant be justified, for he shall bear their iniquities. And finally, he bore the sins of many, the intercession and for transgressions. Well, what does all this mean? Now we come to the 15th verse. Did I have anything here? 15th chapter? Hey, did I mention the 13th chapter? Oh, sure I did. How could I get so lost here? Because I put the wrong label on here. What did I say in the 11th? Oh, this is too good to miss. The sharpness of Abinadi, the character of the man stands out very sharply. Yes. He says, this much I tell you, what you do... Well, this is important. Well, let's go back to the text again for a change. That would be nice, wouldn't it? So then, back here where we are. The king heard these things. He said to them, away with this fellow, for he is mad. Now, that's the great solution. See, that's the Stalinist solution. Nice way to handle your enemy, you see. You don't have to be responsible to him. You don't have to give any answer to anyone. You don't have to explain if a person is mad. Is it an alien mentality? There's nothing in common between you. There's no fault or sin or anything like that. The thing falls completely through. You can do what you want and just put him out of the way. He won't have, by calling him mad, you see, the king won't have the pain of putting a prophet to death, just treat him like a man, lock him up. And on the other hand, he won't be under any responsibility to believe him or anything like that, and that takes care of it. It exonerates both the opponent and both opponents and solves your problem, the alien mentality argument. They use it for Enoch, notice. Abinadi is an Enoch character. John the Baptist, Elijah, Abinadi, Notice, there are wild men. There's a strange thing in the land. A wild man has come among us. He scared them. If they went, it's a culture shock. If they went his way, it would be an awful jolt. And so they have to assume that he's mad. They're frightened. That's a beautiful expression in the Book of Moses there. There's a strange thing in the land. A wild man has come in. Let's go up in the mountains and see the strange guy and listen to what he has to say and his ravings and so forth. It's the same way they treated John the Baptist that way. Remember, he was the mad mullah of the desert. He lived in, dressed in camel skin, lived on wild locusts and honey. And the people went out, flocked out to see him and so forth. And when they asked him who he was, Josephus says an interesting thing here. When people asked him who he was, Josephus doesn't know who his name was. Josephus knows all about him, but he doesn't know his name was John, because he never told anyone his name was John. He said he was Enoch. It's a very interesting thing, and they took him for Enoch Redivivus, the returned Enoch. And of course, Enoch's going to return with Elijah, and Elijah was another one, you see, when they treated the same way. So this is Abinadi character, the wild man prophet, is a masterful invention of Joseph Smith's, if you want to put it that way. This Joseph Smith, he could do almost anything, that kid. Because you're angry with me because I tell you the truth, he says. Oh, touch me not. I have not delivered the message which ye have requested. He says, you asked for the message, don't throw me away now. And he says, you know darn well I'm not mad. But now his faith shone. So he is something special. They're overawed, you see. They durst not lay their hands on him, for the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. His face shone with exceeding luster, even as Moses did on the Mount of Sinai. Oh, and Joseph's in Liberty Jail. Say, we've got an Enoch figure, something very special here. I perceive that it cuts to your hearts because, you see, they were overwhelmed. I perceive that it cuts to your hearts because I tell you the truth concerning your iniquities, yea, and the words fill you with wonder and amazement and anger. The establishment had drifted so far. And then he goes on, but this much I tell you, and here is another very interesting statement here, this 10th verse. This much I tell you, that what you do with me after this shall be a type and shadow of things which are to come. Now, that's a very interesting thing. See, the choice is up to you, he says. You will do according to your nature. Man, satnaka, the Arabs say. A man will do his nature, or as the immortal Heraclitus said, ethos anthropo daemon. A man's character is his fate. What you will do is determined by what you are. And, of course, that's the tragedy, not what happens to you, not what becomes of you, but what you become. It's finished as far as that goes. The Book of Mormon makes that wonderfully clear. It says, long before the Nephites were exterminated, they ceased to be a civilized people. They were finished because of their character and who they were. They couldn't do anything but lose. And so, I tell you, what you do with me shall be a type and a shadow of what will happen to you. You will do according to your nature and suffer accordingly. Your character prescribes the role you play and all its consequences. So you have the stock characters of the new comedy, Plautus, Terence, and so forth in Rome. You have a stock character, you have an old miser, and you have a clever servant, and you have a son who wants to marry his daughter, and so forth. And you know what's going to happen. The miser is going to withhold his money. The servant is going to steal, the clever servant's going to steal the money by a ruse for the son, so the son and the daughter can get married, and all this sort of thing. And each character was a stock plays, and they had a wig. The color, the saucy servant had a red wig. The girl had to be blonde, of course. Everybody had their, and the man had to have the long beard and all this sort. And he had to have a miserly old friend to make more comedy and the like. So your character will determine the role you play in the play. You'll do those things because it's your nature. Will do only according to your nature. Anthropodemon. So, he says, I read unto you the remainder of the commandments. Now notice, here is some of his bitter humor. You'll notice here. They are the great scholars, you see. They've been asking him questions about the scriptures. I read unto you the remainder of the commandments of God, for I perceive that they are not written in your hearts. I have to read them to you now because they're not written in your hearts, you see. Oh, he says, you've studied all your lives. You're great students of what? Oh, iniquity, he says. You studied and taught iniquity all your lives. He commends their study and their knowledge and so forth. But he's going to read a simple thing to them because they don't understand. It's not written in their hearts. And then he says, I perceive that you have studied and taught iniquity the most part of your lives. And that's what they've been saying. They're great students, in other words, but students of iniquity. See, he gets some dirty digs in here. Now the graven image. See, then he refers to the graven image again, because I say graven image, we're getting to be the thing. Bow down and worship him. Then he goes through the Ten Commandments. Well, we have to, time is up now. Yeah, have to resume later.